The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Good morning. That weighs a ton. Well, you know what I mean. I mean, you look at me and you go, well, he might be able to carry 20 pounds, but he can't carry 2,000 pounds. No. That's called hyperbole. You know, hyperbole is when a true statement is made in an exaggerated way to catch your attention, to stir you, to grip you. And hyperbole is important. In fact, you all know what hyperbole is. If you have teenagers in your house, you probably get a lot of hyperbole. It's the overstatement of a truth for the purpose of creating and capturing attention in a vivid and compelling way. Like when your teenage child comes and says, so did you all decide whether I can go to Joe's party? Because everyone is going to be there. And you're thinking, I didn't get an invitation, so everyone is not going to be there. And you say, yeah, we talked about it, and yes, you can go, and you can take the minivan. And the teenager goes, I can't take the minivan. I'll die of embarrassment. And you're thinking, I hope they have EMS on standby. Because we're taking the BMW, you can't have it, you can take the minivan. And so we understand hyperbole. Hyperbole is not a lie, it is an overstatement of truth in a compelling way to get your attention and to get you to think and to get you to respond. Even Jesus uses hyperbole. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. I know no one-eyed disciples of Jesus. That's hyperbole. He's saying, be really attentive to the seriousness of sin. And he uses hyperbole to catch our attention and to engage our hearts in responding to the truth. Why is that important to know? Because Solomon uses hyperbole a lot. And if you don't see that, then you won't be able to engage well in what it is that Solomon is saying in the book of Ecclesiastes. So let me take you to Ecclesiastes, and in fact, if you have a copy of the scriptures, it will be really important for you to open, because we're going to walk through a number of texts today, and it'll help you if you can follow along. Where does this idea of hyperbole in Ecclesiastes come from? Verse 1 and 2 of chapter 1. Here's what he says. We've lived there a few weeks ago. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. All is vapor, smoke, worthless. Clearly that's hyperbole, because if it wasn't, he wouldn't have written Ecclesiastes. Do you understand? If everything is vain, then he would not have written the book, and he would not have encouraged us to read the book. If, in fact, it is, if everything is vain, close the book, go home, we're done. It's hyperbole. It's an overstatement for, well, we want to go, well, what do you then mean, Solomon, when you overstate in order to catch our attention? He's driving at something. In verse 14, he says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun. Really? You've traveled everywhere where everybody lives so that, well, it's hyperbole. It's overstatement. He says, I've really seen so much. And he overstates it, saying, I've seen everything that's happened. And we need to hear well, because if we don't grasp the way he uses hyperbole, we will not feel what Solomon wants us to feel. Hyperbole is used by Solomon to shock us out of our complacency that we think we know what life is all about. He makes extravagant, over-the-top statements for us to go, I don't think about things that way. And Solomon goes, you're right, you don't, and you need to. So as we've been walking through Ecclesiastes, he's made some rather hyperbolic, over-the-top statements, and if it hasn't caused you to go, what? What? What do you mean by that? Then you haven't been listening. You make Solomon safe. You tamp his hyperbolic statements down. You try to find an easy way to explain it so it's not so uncomfortable. Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, wrote this way purposefully, in a sense, to make us uncomfortable. So we start to think about life the way he began to see life. And if we don't let him drive us there, if we don't let him take us to that uncomfortable place of, what can you possibly mean by this? Then we will never embrace what he came to see is the foundation for life. It's really important to recognize how Solomon is writing. So we're going to be in chapter 4, but let's just do a little bit of recap to see where we've been. In chapter 1, he lays out the fact that life under the sun, meaning that we live here, he's talking about daily life. He says daily life has no impact on creation. The sun rises, the sun sets, the wind blows, it blows again, the rivers flow into the ocean is never full, it just keeps on going. And so he says, there's nothing you can do that'll change creation. It's chapter 1. There's nothing that you can do to change the fact that the world continues on without you. Nothing you can do about that. So he draws this conclusion in chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. He goes, you ultimately don't have any impact on the world. Do you feel that? You need to feel that. It's what he wants us to understand. I've seen it all, and I can say that your 30, 50, 70, 80 years on the planet will not have cosmic significance. And we all go, wow. If we're feeling it, we go, wow, yeah. Well, then we should pursue how to live wisely in the midst of all of that life. And so in chapter 2, he explains, I pursued wisdom, and I pursued all kinds of experiences to make sense of daily life. Will a pursuit of wisdom and a rich life experience provide me full insight into the meaning of life, a life that can't change the world? Solomon concludes, no, it can't. Both the wise and the fool end up in the same place. They all die at the end of their days, leaving nothing behind. So it would seem from chapter 2 that pursuing exhaustive understanding, if I could only fully understand, then I can make sense of life. He goes, no, you can't do that either. And he draws this conclusion in chapter 2, verse 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from God. For apart from him, who can eat or have enjoyment? He says, no, the exhaustive pursuit of wisdom and understanding won't provide for you full insight into the meaning of life. So Solomon concludes, so eat and drink, enjoy the labor that God has provided for you, live the day that he presents before you. So Solomon, help me, as I'm living the day, each day as it comes, will I then grasp what it is that God is doing in my life? If I'm just attentive to my daily life and live there, will then I grasp the meaning of life? Last week we lived in chapter 3. It was all about time and how there's a time for this and a time for that. You might remember Terry walked us through that. And the really fascinating and troubling thing about chapter 3 is that there's no pattern to the time. Sometimes it goes from bad to good. Sometimes it goes from good to bad. There's a time to kill, there's a time to heal. There's a time to rejoice, there's a time to mourn, there's a time to gather stones, there's a time to scatter stones. It doesn't seem like there's any pattern. If you read chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, there's no pattern. It just goes. And he then says, God has done this kind of thing. Although we want to make sense of life, look at what he says in chapter 3, verse 11. God has made everything beautiful in its time, appropriate. We go, yes, everything is fitting in its time, so I should be able to see that. And yet, he says in verse 11, he has put eternity into man's heart. We long to have the eternal view. But look at what he says. Yet, God has so worked that man cannot find out what is happening from the beginning to the end. So, do you live in your days? Do you try to live well in your days? Yes. Do you discern the pattern for what God is doing in the universe in your days? Solomon goes, no. You long for that. But God has so worked that you can't see it, he says. You cannot discern it. You got to feel that because that's really critical to understanding where Solomon is going with. So then how do I make sense of life?
God has so ordered life that we will not be able to fully grasp what he is up to. But he says in 3:14, I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Okay. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken away from it. Okay. And God has done this so that we would fear him. What does it mean to fear him? To fear the Lord, it's to live as if he is the biggest, grandest, most valued, most significant thing in life, whether you grasp what he's doing or not. To fear the Lord is to see him, to grasp him, to recognize that he is the biggest, the grandest, the most valued, the most significant thing in life, whether you understand what he's doing or not. That's where Solomon wants to go. And that, in a sense, that conclusion in 3:14, that God has ordered things not so that you would understand it, not that you can make sense of your life, not so that you would see the eternal perspective, but so that you would fear him. But then, if I come to grasp to fear him, then life will play out well, right? If I see what it means to fear him, then I'll understand life, right? Solomon invites us to think with him a little bit more, picking up there in chapter 3, verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun, life as we live it, that in the place of justice, even there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. But what he's saying there is it seems to him, as he looks at life under the sun, as we live daily life, he goes, justice doesn't play out. Do you ever feel that? You're in good company. Solomon, the wisest man in all the world, said the same thing. I look at the way life is lived under the sun, and even though I know God has made everything fitting in its time and it's all appropriate, and I have a longing to see the eternal perspective, I look and I go, justice isn't played out. Picking up in verse 18. So I said in my heart, with regard to the children of men, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts, for what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth. So I saw that there was nothing better than a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? So we go, there's no sense of justice. It's not playing out well. I thought if I were living under the fear of God, I would see how it all plays out. Solomon goes, no, I've seen. Justice doesn't always seem to be played out. But at the end of my life, I can look back and see how it all plays out, right? He goes, no, everyone dies just like the beasts. Now that's hyperbole, obviously, a little bit. We don't hold funeral services for our dead animals, typically. But so what he means by that is everybody dies and all the animals die and life ends. And you might not see how justice plays out before you die. That seems futile. Yes, you need to feel that. Solomon is saying, I've seen it play out. It seems vain. It seems empty. Wow. Again, verse 1, chapter 4. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought, the dead who are already dead are more fortunate than the living who are still alive. Hyperbole, right? Overstatement. It'd be better to be dead than to be living this life. In fact, he goes on to say, and I thought the dead, verse 3, but better than both is he who's not yet been born and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Clearly, overstatement. But get the point. It'd be better to never have been born than to live in this life and not see how it's all playing out. Well, obviously, if you'd never been born, then you wouldn't be, and you wouldn't be able to see, and you wouldn't be able, obviously, overstatement. But he says, life plays out in such a way that you need to grasp. It doesn't make sense. We don't see the eternal. It doesn't seem like justice plays out. He throws up his hands and goes, even those who are fighting to get everything they can get out of life, the ones who exercise their power and oppress others to get as much as they can get out of life, they go, they're not comforted. It doesn't seem to make sense. It seems vain and empty. If the there's no comfort in exerting yourself to get you're exerting yourself over others to get everything you can out of life, because that's where the meaning of life comes. Solomon goes, I've seen that. There's no comfort in that. So then if there's no comfort in being an oppressor, getting everything that you can, if oppressors don't prosper in soul, then look what he says in verses 4, 5, and 6. Then I saw that all the toil and all the skill in work come from man's envy of his neighbor. This is all vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh. Clearly, he's not talking about self-cannibalism. Again, hyperbole, overstatement for the point. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after wind. What's he saying here? He says, well, if you recognize that oppression and exerting yourself over others doesn't bring comfort, then just do what you can in light of what others are doing. Think Facebook. Ooh, you all laughed. What drives Facebook? Rivalry. Right? You post your very worst experiences on Facebook so others can see how depraved and horrible your life is compared to theirs, right? So he goes, well, so if oppression, if exercising your will and your power to get from other people is not where it's at, well, then just live in comparison to other people and you'll find satisfaction. And he goes, no, that's all rivalry. And he says, that's never satisfying. When the fool sees that, he goes, I'll just give up. And then he just becomes self-consumed. There's no satisfaction in even that rivalry, in comparing yourself to others. I can make sense of my life because I look at my life in comparison to their life, and then I conclude that my life is better, so I have some sense of what life is all about. Solomon goes, no, that's vain. That's empty. So then if exercising power over other people doesn't bring satisfaction, if rivalry with other people doesn't bring satisfaction, then I'm just going to live for myself. I will just look at what he says. Verse 7. Okay, maybe then it's living in isolation. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person has no other, either son or brother. Yet there is no end to his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Think of Ebenezer Scrooge in Christmas Carol. Nobody cares for me. I'm not caring for anybody else. I'm just going to live for myself. His life is miserable. When you look at life and you go, it's all about oppression, it's all about rivalry, none of that's satisfying, I guess I'll just live for myself. Solomon says, that's a waste as well. There's no comfort, there's no satisfaction. That's just empty also. Scrooge isn't happy. Neither would you be. Just looking out for oneself, that is ultimately not provide meaning and sense of life. But he doesn't end there. Chapter 4, verse 9. He goes on to say, if isolation, living for yourself, isn't where it's at, how about this? Well, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has no one else to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. It sounds like, so then what we should do is pursue partnership and relationship with others. That's where we're going to find the meaning in life. That's where we're going to experience the kind of life God wants us to experience. But he doesn't stop there. Look at what he says in verse 13 and following. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end to all the people, all whom he led. Yet those who will come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and striving after the wind. What is he talking about? He's presenting a picture. A man who's a king, and he's had an effective rule. And then a poor young man comes from prison, and what ultimately happens? The crowd likes him more than they like the king. The king ends up falling out of favor, and now this young man becomes king. But what's going to happen to him? The crowd is fickle. They'll ultimately not like him. No one will remember him. It will all ultimately, Solomon says, be vanity.
If in fact you think the meaning of life will come because you gather others to partner with you and you'll build really good and rich relationships, Solomon goes, I've noticed those are sometimes fickle. And those you lean on to give you meaning and purpose and sense of life, they'll leave you. They won't value you. They'll go after the next prominent person.
Friends, it's why divorce happens. It's why friendships end. It's why churches split. Solomon saw it.
People are fickle because they're all looking for the meaning in life. And if you're not providing it for them, then they go shop somewhere else. Chapter 4 is provocative and startling and candidly very hyperbolic, overstating the point.
Let me summarize what he's saying in chapter 4. Life doesn't seem to play out just as we think it should. It doesn't play out justly.
All men, even those that we perceive to be good men, they all die the same. So fighting against others in order to get as much as you can, well, he says that ultimately gets you nothing in the end. You're never comforted by that. So maybe just to resign yourself to look after yourself, he goes, that's dissatisfying. It's futile.
But even linking arms with others is no more satisfying because ultimately they're fickle.
Yes, he says, all of this is vanity. All of this is empty. All of this is smoke.
Yes, it is hyperbolic, overstated.
But for the purpose of getting a hold of us, we have to grasp, we have to feel what Solomon is driving at. Because if we don't, we won't welcome the wonderful insight he has as to what makes sense of life.
If we lean on all those crutches, if we lean on all those things that he goes, this isn't helpful, this isn't helpful, this isn't helpful, that's ultimately vain, that's just smoke and mirrors, that's not. If we don't get that, then when he goes, this is what life is all about, we go, no, I'm leaning on this. I'm leaning on that. I got something from here, I got something from there. And if we don't hear what he's saying, none of that provides the satisfaction and meaning for life.
If we don't understand that, then when he does tell us what's at the center of the meaning of life, we won't believe him.
Our sense that we know the best way to make sense of, to live into this beautiful order of life, of God's world, our sense that we know is ultimately unsatisfying. Solomon, seeing life under the sun, experiencing more of life than any of us have ever experienced, and with a God-given sense of wisdom beyond any of our wisdom, says all of that is vanity. All of that is empty. It is pursuing the meaning of life in the wrong way. You're never going to find it there in any of those things in chapter 4. But we pursue them all because we think something will come from this. And he goes, no, I've seen it all. None of it will ultimately give you the rightful sense of the meaning of life. And if we are not willing to let Solomon take us to his end point, feel what he feels, be compelled by the way he's compelled by what he sees, we're not going to learn what he learned and we won't embrace his view of life, and that will be to our detriment. It isn't that we don't see some things. We do. You see some things, of course. Solomon says that enjoying what the Lord has put before you to do each day is good. You should see that. You should recognize that. But we need Solomon to take us to a place where we see and feel and come to understand what he saw and felt. And chapter 4 leaves me in an uncomfortable place.
Wow, all the things I lean on, Solomon goes, not helpful. All the things I look to, Solomon goes, vanity. All the things I rest on, he goes, it's vapor. I go, that's uncomfortable. Why leave me there?
Now listen, Jesus at times leaves his hearers in uncomfortable places because they need to be challenged to think, to feel, to drill down deep on what's going on in their souls. That's what Solomon is doing. Nicodemus comes to Jesus and says, you're an amazing man. We know that no one could be doing the things that we're doing unless God was with him. And Jesus looks at Nicodemus and says, Nicodemus, you need to be born again. And Nicodemus is clueless. We go, we know what Jesus is talking about. Nicodemus didn't. Nicodemus is confused. What do you mean born again? How can a man enter back into his mother's womb? That can't happen. Jesus says, unless you're born again, you can't see the kingdom. Unless the Spirit works, then you're not going to experience kingdom life. And that's the end of the conversation. How do you think Nicodemus walked away going, yay, I understand everything about life and what God... No. What was Jesus doing? Jesus was leaving, intentionally leaving Nicodemus in a place where he had to think about, what am I thinking? He had to wrestle with, what am I living for? That's what Jesus was doing. When Jesus is speaking to the religious leaders, he asks them a question. He says, how is it that David calls Messiah his Lord? Now, we know the answer to that. We think we know the answer to that. We've read more. I mean, later revelation. We think we... But you know, when Jesus raised the question with the religious leaders, they didn't understand that. When you're reading Ecclesiastes, please do not import what you think you know about where the story is going in order to not feel uncomfortable with what Solomon is saying. Do you know what I'm saying? Please do not import what you think you know about where the story is going, where life is going, what the eternal perspective is, to avoid feeling uncomfortable with what Solomon is saying. It may be good for us to listen to Solomon and realize that we might not think well about all we think about what God is doing. Back to 3:11. Look at what he says. So Solomon is leading up to 3:11 through 14. And then in chapter 4, he unpacks the grounds for why 3:11 through 14 is the right reason. God has made everything beautiful in his time, in its time. He has put eternity in man's heart, yet so that man cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. God did that. He placed a longing for eternity in you, and then he worked in such a way that you will not see the answer. What wickedness is that? No, that's really good. That's really right. Because if, in fact, you thought you knew the plan, then what would you be trusting in? The plan. Do you understand? If you thought you knew the plan for life, then you would be living dependent on the plan and your understanding of the plan. That's not God's intention. He's worked in such a way that you wouldn't know the beginning from the end. And look at what he says in verse 14. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it all so that we'd have it figured out. God has done it all so that we would feel comfortable in the way we're living. God has done it all so that we would see the beginning from the end. No, God has done it all just as he did so that you would fear him. I think I have a problem. I think I have a capacity. I think I have the capacity to fully understand what God is doing in the world. Well, maybe not in the whole world, but at least in my life, I think I have a capacity problem. I think I can grasp it. This is what God is doing in my life, and this is where it's all headed. Solomon goes, no, God has worked in such a way that you'll never grasp that. Because if I thought I could grasp it, then I'll depend on me and my understanding of the plan rather than coming to where Solomon comes. Here's the best thing. Fear God. Fear, that's the foundation that he's driving at. If I think my sense of justice or the fullness of my days by getting as much as I can out of life, or my advancement in comparison to others, or living for the support and friendship of others will bring a satisfying answer to the question, what is the ground for life that we live? It's not those things are bad. But if I think those things are the grounds for understanding a satisfying life, we'll miss what Solomon wants us to see, what he discovered. Friends, I talk, as we've been walking through Ecclesiastes, there's this sense, but we know where eternity is going, right? You know where the end of the story is, right? I kind of go, maybe. Paul the Apostle can write and say, eye is not seen, eye is not heard, eye is not seen, ear is not heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man what God has prepared. But don't we know where the story is going? Maybe. Maybe, but maybe not as much as we think we know. And as a result, if we think we know, these are the things that will make life meaningful and satisfying. And Solomon goes, I've lived there. I've experienced that. I conclude all of those things are not worth resting on. Beneath it all is the fear of God. In Revelation chapter 6, saints who were martyred are under the altar, looking at how the universe is playing out as they're waiting for the return of the Lord. And they ask the question, how long until you work this out? They have much more of the eternal perspective than we do, and they still don't understand it all. And we go, oh, but I understand what's going on in life. Really, do you? Maybe as long as I think I know what's going on in life, then I will not be so prone, I will not be more likely to trust the one who's a master of life. That's Solomon's point. As I've been living in Ecclesiastes, I've also been looking at Job. You read Job and you go, oh, we see what God's doing in Job's life. We get the beginning where Satan comes. And some of you are familiar with the book of Job. You know what? Job never got that. Job never got the eternal perspective on his life. We go, but I've read it. I know what was going on. Yeah, but living in it, Job didn't know. Job didn't know. The book starts with God speaking and saying, have you considered my servant Job, a perfect and upright man, one who fears me? That never changes. Job doesn't know what's going on in his life. We do. We're spectators looking on the outside. We have given by the Spirit of God through the book of Job something, not complete, but something of an eternal perspective. Job never sees that. But partway through the book, he says these kinds of things. He goes, I know my Redeemer lives. He doesn't say, and I know how it's all playing out. No, he goes, I know my Redeemer lives. I know that I will see him. That's as much as he knows. Because he fears the Lord. Lost everything. Couldn't make sense of it. His godly wife says, curse God and die. Job says, you're foolish. Solomon would agree, you're foolish. Job would tell us, I don't understand how it's all playing out. But beneath it all, I fear God. I fear God. He is the biggest, the grandest, the most valued, the most significant thing in all of life, whether I grasp what he's doing or not. Friends might help me see that. Worship times might help me see that. Others might help me see that. But I do not rest on any of that. I'm coming to rest on God, who is the biggest, the grandest, the most valued, the most significant thing in all of life. Now, Solomon has much more to share with us. You have to come back next week to see what he says about what should you then do when you walk into the presence of God. That'll be mind-blowing. That'll be provocative. Why? Not because Solomon is trying to be provocative, but because Solomon sees life this way, and I see life this way. And he's going, well, I've seen life from your perspective. I've done life from your perspective. Let me tell you, that's empty. Here's how life should be viewed. And as he turns my soul to see life differently, it feels really uncomfortable. I don't want to go there. But ultimately, Solomon lovingly, brilliantly, hyperbolically at times, tells us the truth. Here's the thing. The thing most to be valued is the fear of God. And at this point, you should be going, wow, I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know how do I live into that. You've just cut the legs out, Solomon, of everything that I tend to trust in and look to and make sense of life. And what does that mean? Come back next week. I'm not trying to play a game. I'm just saying I only have 35 minutes. I can't unpack all of Ecclesiastes. And friends, if you are feeling uncomfortable, a little undone right now, I would say that is both Solomon's intent and the Spirit's work. Because unless we allow the Spirit to cut out from underneath us all the things we rest on to make sense of life, we will not ultimately rest on him. So, happy Sunday, right? It's like, I wrestled as I was thinking through this message. How can I bring it to a happy conclusion? Chapter 4 doesn't come to a happy conclusion. It comes to a really good and healthy conclusion. Solomon is the soul doctor who says, you have all these symptoms. You keep trying to take care of them yourself. You don't understand how serious the problem is. Let me help you understand how serious it is and how magnificent the solution is. Nothing else. Beneath it all, the fear of God. And we need to know what that means. Chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, he'll help us understand. He's not going to leave it without clarity, but he will leave us with some discomfort because it's needed. Do you understand? It's needed. Let's pray. I'm glad, Jesus, to hear you at times say things to those who are following you that don't leave them comfortable. Because that then leaves them challenged, thoughtful, engaged. So I'm glad to see that, because then when I find it in Solomon's writings, I'm not undone. Your intention is to move us to places of holy discontent so that ultimately we can come to a holy understanding. Something you'll have to do. I flee to comfort. I strategize and plan for what makes sense of my own life on my own terms. And Solomon, wiser, more experienced than me, goes, Brian, give it up. I don't want to, but I do. I do. I want to let go of everything that gets in the way of my understanding what it means to truly fear you.
Thank you for joining for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child the repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.